From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capitol Notes podcast for Friday, July 15th. I'm John Myers from KQED. Anthony York, who has returned to our lovely podcast, is doing, I don't even know what this game is called. People typically
with a knife.
Have done it with a knife where they go between their fingers.
Yeah.
And he's doing it with
I'm doing a low-stakes version.
He's doing it with his pen. That just shows his level of engagement here as he returns to the mighty podcast fold.
Who am I? Why am I here?
You've been very missed on this podcast.
Yes. And
all the people who have written in asking, what happened to Anthony?
Right. And who is it? My mother?
Your mother, your father.
Yeah.
Exactly. Your wife. She wanted to know why you weren't home.
Yeah.
And podcast, which was absent last week, and there could be some hiatus weeks this summer, folks, because things will calm down, and we all may be taking time off, and, you know, life may move on. So fear not. When something good happens, we will be here on a Friday. Someone will be here.
Someone will be here.
And we're not sure anything good happened this week, but it's a good time to take stock of where we are, because the legislature has left town. Let's hear the applause, folks. That's a mild amount of applause. The first full-on legislative summer recess in a long time.
Yes.
I've said the last couple of podcasts when you weren't here that this is only the second summer in 10 that I haven't been sitting around waiting on a budget.
Right.
And so it's a very strange feeling. But the legislature took their month recess. They ended on Thursday. They won't be back until mid-August or as I like to call it, they come back exactly when their new political maps are certified by the Redistricting Commission.
Scheduled to be.
And so we just thought that we would sit here and give some sense of kind of take stock of where things are. So let's take stock first. So
okay,
where are things? Let's get Anthony to give us some of his smart thinking on what happened at the end of the great big fight and the end of the budget and Jerry Brown win, lose, or draw?
Well, I think what happened in sort of trying to understand what this experience, what this last 6 months means in terms of the next 6 or 12 or 18, I really do believe this is probably the end of the Democrats trying to engage in a bipartisan budget deal, unless the wheels really fall off here in the next few months. I just think that the focus now is on November 2012, that and getting through the budget. I don't think the administration is going to spend a lot of time trying to engage Republicans. That's the big takeaway I get.
You feel as though that they have learned their lesson in a sense that they're not going to get anything or get what they want or whatever it would be?
I do. I mean, that's my feeling just from talking to folks in the administration. I don't know if you have a different feeling or not, but you kind of have to look at this collectively. I mean, look at what's going on in D.C., and Brown always likes to point to what's going on outside of the cocoon here in California. The tenor of the debt ceiling debate in D.C., I just think that and obviously some people in the administration who I'm sure you've talked to as well are more vocal about this line of thinking than others. But I just kind of get the sense, and it's just kind of an impressionistic view, that they feel like there's no benefit and nothing good that can come out of negotiations with Republicans at this point. And I'm sure there will be some sort of perfunctory effort, in the next budget. But I think that the real focus is on November 2012, when you get a new crop of legislators elected under these new rules and new maps that you alluded to earlier. And also this ballot war that will have taken place, presumably by then. And I don't think it's one that the governor will be necessarily actively involved in, but will sort of allow these fights over revenue and things like that to just sort of play out on a parallel track outside of the legislature.
Well, I think that's a smart analysis, and for really for one simple reason, which is that what the governor wants and what he has wanted all along, and I don't think his wants have changed substantially, either in what he didn't get or just kind of the way he's approached the beginning of the job and what needs to be done. What he wants, he's not going to get. And so it would be effectively beating his head against a wall there. And that's, and I think it's important to point out, I mean, that's not to say, and I do believe that Republicans feel as though the narrative has all been about that they're obstructionist. And I do think that there is a little bit of a point that Republicans have, which is that they feel as though when they have said what they believe, they're considered obstructionists. When Democrats say what they believe, they're being considered principled. And that they believe that they have been unfairly castigated out there. And so I want to put that forward because when I say the governor's beating his head against a wall, not getting what he wants, it doesn't mean as though he is right and they are wrong. But there's no middle ground there. There's not enough middle ground to make it worth the Brown administration's time or the Democratic legislature's time.
Well, they're
not going to find a resolution in negotiation. And I think if nothing else, what we have to take from that is that the governor misread, misjudged, or was overly optimistic about what he could do and what he could change.
Or made one good shot at it and isn't going to trouble himself with that again until something else changes. I mean, I think that's sort of you know, where we are. And of course, obviously, I mean, the counter from the administration to that argument you just laid out would be, hey, Democrats did do something. They made some cuts that they were very uncomfortable making. They, as the governor so often talked about, they got out of their comfort zone on a lot of these things and made some real ongoing cuts to some social programs that they hold dear. But that didn't do anything to change the Republican position on taxes. And again, drawing the parallel to Washington, I mean, it does sound similar when you have folks saying, you know, on the debt ceiling debate that we're all for reducing the debt, but we don't want increased taxes to be part of that solution.
I wonder if, I mean, it wouldn't have changed the outcome, and we don't have to belabor this too much longer, but it wouldn't have changed the outcome that we had about what happened from January to July, if the governor had presented a different tax package, because the Republican opposition wasn't to the package as it existed; it was to the notion of additional tax dollars.
Right.
It would not have changed the outcome in the short term, but in the long run, I wonder if the governor had chosen a different path on a different package of taxes, would it have changed what's going to happen later this year and into 2012.
What do you mean?
If the governor had put up some taxes that maybe had a more sellable appeal. I mean, look at the polling. Look at the polling on higher income taxes. Look on the upper brackets. Look at the polling on oil extraction tax. I mean, my point is that, you know, you heard Democrats for so long say that they were not a fan of the governor's approach and that they thought the tax package would have lost anyway at the polls. But had they been different taxes that they could try to run a more populist campaign, big government, you know, big corporations, small people, you know, and on and on and on.
Right.
And therefore, has it not really left them on great footing for 2012 that they might have had? In which case, some would wonder, should Jerry Brown have picked different taxes rather than something that everyone was going to hate?
Well, it's a different political calculus because the reason that Brown chose the taxes he did, these broad-based higher levels of income, sales, and car taxes that the most people pay. The reason he chose that was to try to appeal to the business community, which has historically been okay with some of those broad-based taxes and less so when you're talking about targeted taxes, whether it's, you know, the sin taxes on alcohol and
either tobacco. Either appeal to them or negate their political opposition.
Right. And so that's what Brown was trying to avoid. That was the political calculation he was making. He wanted a broad-based coalition. He wanted to eliminate any funded opposition, neutralize the business community, and eventually, I think, you know, was hoping to get help from the business community to deliver Republican votes. And I think that's one of the other stories of what we just went through here was, I mean, you read the story about how New York passed the gay marriage bill, right? And a lot of the narrative has to do with the Republicans being leaned on by the business community to support this thing I mean, that was a real striking difference in reading that story. You know, all these comparisons came out, fair or unfair, between Brown and Cuomo. But the real interesting comparison to me was sort of how New York Republicans are different than California Republicans. And and the sway of the business community. I mean, I think this is another thing that we need to look at going forward. And again, given the new rules, the new election rules in 2012, you know, the business community, for all intents and purposes, largely defined, was behind the governor's proposal. I mean, there were qualified endorsements from groups like the Chamber of Commerce and some of these regional chambers.
Other groups were de facto endorsements, I would argue.
Other groups like the retailers were more direct in their endorsement, you know, even though there was a sales tax increase on the board. And so, but that didn't amount to any Republican votes at the end of the day. And so, you know, again, this is going to be a matter of perspective about whether, you know, the Democrats were beholden to their union masters or whether, you know, there was wide consensus for a deal that couldn't get done because the business community was unable to deliver Republican votes, and whether the blame for that lies with the administration and their failure to lean on the business community heavily enough, or just their lack of ability to deliver, that the state chamber of commerce in New York might be able to deliver five Republicans, but not so in California.
And I wonder, and it's a great point, because I think maybe that is an ongoing story and an ongoing interesting narrative here in politics in California,
right?
Which is. Where does the business community, and that mainstream business community, and the chamber kind of represents that, and some people will say the chamber maybe is too much big business, right, and not small business. I don't want to quibble over that to try to make my broader point because I don't want to slow myself down. Right. But
too late.
I've already done it. But what is the political outlet for the business community in the state then? If they are unsuccessful with the Republican Party in the legislature, they have their differences, long-standing differences, on legislation and other issues with the Democratic Party in the legislature. Where is their home? Where does their money go? Where is their influence? Is their influence waning? Do they have to reassess what their abilities are? I mean, you know, we've heard this and kind of rumblings about the California Republican Party, and is it going to have money next year? Are all of its money people going to walk away because it's been too driven by these ideological issues that the donors aren't happy with? I mean, we all know these narratives. But if you're big business and you have a seat at the table, or you want a seat at the table, and you've always had one in politics in the state, what's your outlet now?
Well, it's the initiative. I mean, that's the easy answer. And so, you know, I mean, one of the questions, again, as we look towards November, and we should be seeing here probably over the next 3, 4, 5 months, some of these ballot initiatives taking shape and being submitted to the Attorney General's office, and the question there is the same as what we just went through, is will that coalition, this sort of loose coalition of business and labor, try to hammer out a deal on some revenue proposals, or will it be, you know, what Brown referred to, paraphrasing Thomas Hobbes, will it be the war of all against all, where you have a fight over, you know, perhaps split roll on Prop 13, or an oil severance tax, or a tax on the wealthiest. You know, we've got a situation where it looks like we're going to have another fight over union dues, that there's an initiative headed to the ballot on that. So you know, what could that be, a negotiating chip? Do they not submit the signatures if there's a, you know, sort of a negotiated tax package on the ballot? You know, all of these things, I think that if you're looking to the answers for some of the big political questions, you're going to have to start looking outside of the Capitol, outside of the legislature, and towards the initiative process.
looking outside of the Capitol and looking to a different place, which would be the courts, I wanted to talk a little bit about what this is shaping up to be. The summer of legal battles over just about everything. Let's start with the budget. The budget is shaping up to be sent to court on several issues. We're expecting any day now a lawsuit challenging the redevelopment proposal, right, which was $1.7 billion in this budget deal and $400 million every subsequent year under the reconfiguration of local redevelopment agencies and those property tax dollars. That is first and foremost the biggest battle, the marquee battle, I think I would call it, out of the lawsuits at this point. Though making a strong
first five.
Well, I was going to say making a strong case for second place of marquee, not even that one, is the Amazon battle.
Right.
Whether it goes to court or whether it's just a referendum on the online sales tax issue,
and much then right smaller dollar figure. Right? That's about $200
million in the budget. And then, yeah, there are the pending court cases from several other issues there. And we haven't gotten to redistricting, which we'll get to in a moment.
Right.
But just staying on the budget, those are interesting. And the redevelopment one, I mean, that's huge. That's
right.
Huge from a dollar perspective.
Well, and the other one that you didn't mention is this the fight over the sale leaseback. Governor Schwarzenegger signed a deal that would call for the sale of a bunch of state office buildings, would have netted about $1.2 billion for the state in the short term, and they would lease back the office space. Brown walked away from that deal, and and the group sued. And so it's a strange thing where if the state loses the lawsuit, they will gain $1.2 billion, right? So at least in the short term. So there's that lawsuit, the tobacco lawsuit, the first five, where they tried to take $1 billion, yeah. From.
And I also failed to mention the expected lawsuit. I think there will be one over the firefighting fee, $150 fee on rural property owners, and whether that was a fee or a tax under Prop 26 and all of
right.
that. So I would expect that is a lawsuit. The Howard Jarvis folks have certainly been rattling their sabers that they would take that to court. So
right. So you've got couple of billion plus, $3-4 billion total tied up in litigation, and but also more than just the dollars, it's going to sort of set the tenor for things going forward. I mean, things like the redevelopment suit are going to have huge consequences for state policy going forward, as will, I think, that the firefighting lawsuit that you mentioned, in terms of how liberal and fast and loose the Democratic majority can play with, calling things fees and having them be exempt from Proposition 26 while they're still short of their two-thirds majority.
Yeah.
But then also redistricting. You did.
Yeah, well, two-thirds majority gets is a bit of a nice transition to the other issue. The real brewing fun over the summer, and I use the term fun loosely, though for people
yes.
like me it's fun because I must be demented enough to,
yes,
to do what I do.
Clearly.
Clearly. It's clear even in radio.
Yes.
Is the end of the saga, or at least the end of chapter one of redistricting. The Independent Citizens Commission that was part of Prop 11 and modified by Prop 20, the 14 men and women on that have been going through all the process of drawing legislative districts, congressional districts, Board of Equalization districts. They are scheduled to finish drawing maps at the end of July, 28th maybe, or the 31st.
The
they've given themselves a little bit of wiggle room. And then they believe, and I'm not quite sure that the Prop 11 is as clear as they say it is, but whatever. They believe that they've got to then give the public 14 days to look at the maps, and then they're going to formally vote on the maps on August 15th.
Right.
And I believe, as I'm sure Anthony would agree, that on the 15th, on the 16th, some very moment after that, the referendum will be filed, the lawsuit will be filed, and off will go to court challenging the maps.
Yeah. In fact, the chairman of the state Republican Party implied this week,
Tom Del Beccaro.
Yeah, implied this week that they were headed in that direction. So, we'll see what the maps look like. On one side, you're seeing some pushback. Remember, all these things can be referended, and they can be referended individually. In terms of, there could be a referendum just on the Senate maps, or just on the Assembly maps, or just on the congressional maps, or I guess just on the BOE maps theoretically, but that would be odd.
Although that sounds like a political quagmire if you don't like the maps. If you've got four or three different referendum measures on a ballot, it seems a hell of a lot easier than for someone, for the voters to get just like, I'm not sure the dynamics. I don't really know what the dynamics are there for you. I mean, we haven't seen an actual ballot fight over political maps, over redistricting in a long time, really in a generation in California. I mean, everything else has been done through the courts. And ultimately, the state Supreme Court could, in fact, appoint special masters and draw the maps again themselves.
They did.
What's interesting about the commission so far and what they have done, I mean, they've been pilloried over the last, especially the last 7 to 10 days, I would argue, by some. And with due respect to some of the pundits in the state who have, bemoaned that the whole thing has collapsed, having sat in the commission for the last few days this week, I wrote a story on this week, I'm not completely convinced that's the case. I mean, I do think that they have found it more complicated than maybe they even thought. I think that they have not left themselves a lot of time to finish the map drawing. But But they are trying. It seems to me that they are trying to kind of follow the impossible mandate set out by independent redistricting, which is to listen to communities and give communities what they want, but then follow the federal laws about the voting rights of minorities.
Right.
Those are very conflicting things. We've seen it several times, especially in the LA area. In some of these communities in Los Angeles, in Southeast LA County, in some of those smaller cities, with populations, the African-American population, the Latino population, to an extent, the Asian-American population, that you cannot do both. You cannot keep cities and communities whole and honor the Voting Rights Act about Section 2, minority-majority
right.
districts. I could go on and on and on. But they are they're conflicting goals. And so they become value judgments at some point. I mean, obviously, some of it's the law and what they have to do to not get overturned by the courts. But some of it becomes value judgments about, you know, how you set this out. And I do think that the commission has not it has not left itself a lot of time to wrestle that to the ground. I think that the divisions in the commission are going to have to come up at some point. And they're not partisan political ones. I think that's a overly simplistic way of looking at what they're doing. These aren't really diehard. Again, due respect to some
right.
pundits, these aren't really diehard Democratic, liberal, I mean, Republican Party people.
No.
But they have different ideologies, geographical, regional, partisan, personal. And some of that's going to have to come out at some point. So,
well, and that's why they delayed the vote this
yeah.
week, because the vote would bring that conflict on the board to a head. And I think they're trying to build a consensus here over the next couple of weeks, you know, if they can, at least among themselves, because each. Was 2/3 of the Democrats have to approve the maps, as do 2/3 of the Republicans and 2/3 of the independents, right?
Yep.
So,
yep.
So
it's a supermajority among
each
faction
group.
Of the commission.
Right. So the idea is for at least for there to be some consensus among this multi-partisan group and then go from there. And that consensus is still elusive. And, you know, whether or not they can reach that in the next couple of weeks, I mean, I think you're right. Look, in this process, there are going to be winners and there are going to be losers, and the losers are going to get lawyers and they're going to sue. I mean, that's just – it's kind of part and parcel for these types of things. Historically, challenges to district maps have not been terribly successful, but that doesn't mean that I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Well, a couple of things that I think are worth pointing out is that in watching the commission, it seems to me that if you look at the ones who are identified as Democrats and the one that's identified as Republicans, they're very different there. And I do think that's why you hear Del Beccaro and other Republicans very unhappy with the commission. Now, they want to point out the map drawing firm and all these other things. But I think if you look at the people who are Republican registered on the commission, they are not as diehard Republican to me as the Democrats, and not all the Democrats on the commission. But you have some much stronger social justice people, you know, those kinds of communities among the Democratic members of the commission. The Republican members of the commission seem to be pretty, I don't know, for lack of a better word, mild.
Hmm.
You know, and I think that may be what frustrates some of the diehard Republicans out there is that. You know, the Republicans who were picked through this process are not diehard, true blue, passionate Republicans. I'm not saying they're not, but you know what I'm saying?
It's, right.
There's an intensity level difference there that I see between the commission. And then also, too, let's talk about the incumbents who are all kvetching.
Yes.
That. There's a new word for the podcast. Usually I say kerfuffle, but today it's kvetching.
Going Yiddish.
And yeah, none of this is my own background. Over these maps. I mean, you continually get the congressional maps redrawn. You see some powerful incumbents move around. You did a very nice piece that showed that Janice Hahn's win in the special election this week may be
fleeting.
Yeah. Exactly. That she may get drawn into a district that's not so hot for her, that puts her in with other incumbents.
Right. Go
ahead.
Well, it seemed like in the Hahn case, there were sort of two options that the commission was looking at yesterday. One would put Hahn in a district that ran up the coast and was basically the district now represented by Henry Waxman. And the other district would be a sort of a Long Beach district that Hahn hasn't represented, that as of now has both Linda Sanchez and Laura Richardson in the district, and Senator Alan Lowenthal is running for that seat as well. So
yeah.
Crowded.
You've got some valley districts that remain tough for incumbents. You've got, and then in the Assembly of the Senate, you've got some people who are getting very interestingly drawn around there. I mean, there is a feeling that, you know, that Democrats would be on the threshold of their two-thirds vote, depending on
right.
where some of those districts are laid out. So it's going to be interesting. And yeah, I think we should have all known that we were going to end up in court with this one way or the other. The other thing I was going to say about the commission is Prop 11 mandates that they do this, but they seem to be taking great care to write a narrative, literally write a narrative, a set of documents that explain their thinking, which will help their case, one would argue, in court, where a judge or an appellate court or whoever it is, or the Supreme Court, because they automatically go to the right. Supreme Court, will get to see what the thinking of the commission was about why the lines went certain places. And that will be interesting because this time it won't be a, you know, when they were done by the legislature, it was all done behind closed doors. Nobody right. had a document of saying, and actually they didn't want a document that says, I'm giving you that district, you're getting that district. Right. This is going to be much more laid out. So that could be interesting. So who knows?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. It'll be fun. Is that it?
I think that's it. Anything else happen?
No. You having a good summer?
So far, so good.
Just in case any of you were curious how he's doing. That's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times, and I'm John Myers from KQED. And again, like I said, we may miss a couple of weeks this summer, but
no.
Don't worry. If we're not here, that means nothing big happened, right?
There you go.
Yeah, just continue with your pool party.
Yeah,
we'll see you next time. Thanks.